From the Roots Up. CIUT 89.5 FM. Toronto.
Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. Today we hope to be talking with Kim Ives of HaitiLiberté.com. I really urge listeners to go to that site. It's Kim Ives we had on the show some months back. He spoke to the United Nations Security Council in December last year. We had him on the show following that, but it was a most enlightening account of the circumstances facing Haiti today, domestically and foreign, you could say. They have the problem, the question posed by others of intervention. And the latest reports, you can read Black Agenda Report and other places where they're talking about this, involved an old nemesis of the Taylor Report, you might call it, the regime of Paul Kagame of Rwanda. Paul Kagame himself showed up at a meeting in a CARICOM meeting, I believe it was. I don't have to be precise. It was a meeting where leaders in the region were talking about intervening, and he was being invited to be one of those people. I think we're joined now by Kim Ives. Are you there, Kim?
Yes, I'm here.
Hey, Kim, thank you very, very much for joining us. I was just saying that we seem to, when we talk about Haiti these days and these years, it always seems to involve a well-known superpower trying to sort out who might attack that country to help them out. And you have spoken to us on this show previous. But I want to do one thing, if you don't mind, by way of introduction of yourself and this problem. You did write about an outstanding Haitian leader and revolutionary theoretician, Ben Dupuy.
Yes.
And I very much regret that we had not reached you earlier on this subject. It seems to me, if you don't mind, it seems to me Ben Dupuy's life and the issue we're going to talk about, which is intervention, they're all of a piece. And one last note I have to say is a very good friend of the show, Ramsey Clark, I learned by reading your article in Haiti Liberté, was close to Mr. Dupuy, and that really lifted my spirits, I have to tell you. It's a great article. But anyway, please tell us, what would Ben Dupuy make of the current situation, and what is his story?
Well, his story is that he was exiled, essentially, by the Duvalier regime in the mid-60s because of his organizing of workers in the Reynolds Metals mine in Miragoan, and also for his activism in the radio world. He was part of Radio Haiti at the time, which was probably Haiti's largest radio. And they were all inspired by the Cuban Revolution right across the Windward Passage in Cuba. And so one day, a friend of his who was part of the Tontamacut, the paramilitary force of the Duvaliers, was speaking to him and said, "Listen, you had better get out of the country because they're coming for you."
Mm-hmm.
So he did, and he came to New York, and he proceeded to become one of Haiti's foremost communist revolutionaries in the state, and organized many very successful and meaningful actions against the Duvalier regime in an underground way until the fall of the regime in 1986, after which he moved his operation of a newspaper, a weekly newspaper, Haiti Progre, to Haiti, where it became really the organ of the movement that brought Jean-Bertrand Aristide to power. So Ben Dupuis played a very key role in Aristide's rise and was then in really that period of the ensuing coup d'etat and occupation, the principal voice against U.S. intervention and handing over Haiti to the U.N. Security Council, which at that time was completely dominated by the U.S. And he, in fact, resigned his post as itinerant ambassador for Haiti, to which he was appointed by Aristide in 1993 because Aristide chose to allow the U.N. to put Haiti under it, or Haiti allowed the U.N. to put itself under
Chapter 7
power, yeah, to which he said, you know, that's going to be very hard to get out of. And right now, Haiti is once again back in Chapter 7 status because the U.S. is angling in one way or another with the benefit of its right hand, Canada, to once again intervene in Haiti.
But there's such a his story was so remarkable because he was at that intersection where the Soviet Union, I guess the agreed word is collapsed, and George Bush had told us all that we were going to now live in a new world order, and there were so many people who were in movements who were such as Ben Dupuis, who folded up along with the Soviet Union. But my impression is Ben didn't fold up.
No, he did not. And really, that was such, I remember it very well, that just the total discouragement which pervaded the movement here in the United States. At the time, the Sandinistas had just been ousted from power. The Soviet Union was, it hadn't quite finished collapsing in 1990, but it was clearly on the way. So there was a real discouragement. So when the Haitian people stood up and took power in 1990 by electing Jean-Bertrand Aristide as their president in the election of December 16th, 1990, it was just a euphoria that swept not only Haiti, but I can say large portions of the progressive community in the United States. And, you know, people were just so heartened, and
yes,
of course, most importantly, Hugo Chavez in Venezuela and Evo Morales in Bolivia and the Sandinistas recently ousted in Nicaragua all said, well, you know, it's possible to do something down this new path of basically taking the elections which so far have been engineered by the U.S. and seizing them back, and hence began the pink tide.
It's such a story. By the way, I didn't realize the name Lavalas came from that. It was like a landslide, right?
Avalanche. Flood. Flood is usually refers to water, so that people call it the flood.
Yeah, and it led to a great, really an important conversation where the Aristide elements had to decide what they were going to do after he was knocked from power by the army. And that was such an important discussion, and you cover it so well in HaitiLiberté.com. And I really urge people to read this. But two things were said there that I was very struck by. One was that those who were opposed to Ben Dupuis' school of thought said, we have to find basically the right Americans to work with.
Right.
And then he had raised the matter of, well, we have friends around the world, including Mr. Gaddafi of Libya, which apparently that was a non-starter with them. But,
right.
You know, but once you say, well, we're going to have to find the right American, you're in a lot of trouble.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know if you heard that, by the way, but
if it were
where we're broadcasting, there's actually a thunderstorm in the background. It seems to be trying to help us out. By every time you say anything significant, there's thunder.
Yeah. Well, the Lava Last movement was, in fact, an alliance of the popular masses of Haiti and a part of the bourgeoisie, what we could call the bourgeoisie éclairée, the enlightened bourgeoisie, which was supposed to be sort of liberal and nationalist of sorts. But, you know, as Lenin once said, bourgeoisies always betray their own revolution. And this, in a way, was the case in point. The bourgeoisie became completely cowed and terrified, you know, by this coup, and, you know, started to look at it as a technical problem. You know, we just have to find, I remember very well, Jean Casimir, then the ambassador to Washington, saying at a meeting somewhere in October 1991, just after the coup, we just have to find the right levers, as if it was all a question of just finding, and, you know.
There's a wrench somewhere in Washington.
Right. It's just the right wrench. We got to find the wrench to fit, you know, and that's all it is. But, of course, it was a political struggle, and, you know, they tried to bring Aristide back as in a cage, sort of as a camouflage for the neoliberal policy they wanted to put in place. And Aristide sort of played along, but he used a tactic very common in Haitian resistance over the centuries, which is called marronnage. And that was the defense that the slaves employed during the slavery period of the colony of Saint-Domingue, which is when the French colonists would tell them to do something, they couldn't openly resist or they'd be beheaded or killed, mm-hmm. or whatever, but so they would kind of do a sidestep or a backstep. They would say, yes, yes, sir, but then do something else. And that's called marronnage. It's basically where you pretend to go along, but really you try to sabotage and slow walk it, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And that's what Aristide tried to do, but the U.S. was immediately wise to it, and they said, okay, this guy, we got to get him out of there. And they did, you know, in 1996, he was shown a door.
Just an utterly humiliating process to watch him yanked out of power by the Americans, put on a plane, mm-hmm. and have his, by the way, when they returned him, he'd been out of office 3 years because they had removed him, but they didn't give him the 3 years back. They pretended he'd been there serving, therefore he couldn't run, right?
Right. Well, that was the whole struggle in late 1994 after his return. Was he going to get his 3 years back or not? And there was a big conference in Miami. Jesse Jackson was there, Ramsey Clark, a number of others came, and they all said he should get his 3 years. When the coup happened, the clock stopped. He gets his 3 years, and the people were clamoring for that. But the U.S. Basically put the kibosh on that after he dressed down the U.S. ambassador and the head of the U.N. mission, Brahimi, in the Port-au-Prince Cathedral in late 1995. And they said, okay, that's it. He's got to go. And he did.
Yes. Turned out, the wrong tool. We're speaking to Kim, right. Kim Ives, HaitiLiberté.com. And so that brings us, by the way, you're quite right. Canada keeps playing a nasty role. By the way, it's not so visible, and I'm really glad you speak of it, because they've been actively involved several times in these coups, and are quite proud of it in Ottawa. But mm-hmm. now we have this new, I'm going to call it a curveball. They've had a meeting in CARICOM, or people make up CARICOM, and of all states that showed up or representatives, there was someone from Kenya, and then America's favorite African leader, Paul Kagame of Rwanda, who, by the way, has soldiers all over Africa on hire. What was that all about, and what's going to happen?
Well, you know, they're trying to put a sort of a black face on what is essentially a U.S. and Canadian operation, and they're hoping to also get the imprimatur or the benediction of the U.N. I don't think that's going to happen. I think the Chinese and the Russians, who are now, you know, finally feeling their oats, as it were, are not going to go along with the U.S. rubber stamping of or deputizing some other coalition of nations to intervene in Haiti. So I think they're going to end up having to go in with a sort of coalition of the willing, if you will, what they called the coalition that went into Iraq. So I believe that the future will be this CARICOM with Kagame, who of course is a close U.S. ally in Africa as well as Kenya, in this operation, which will maybe occur in the next month or two.
You really think? There is that kind of danger.
Oh yes, no, I think it's. You know, they're very set on it, and you know, Haiti is very key in the chessboard of the Caribbean. You have, of course, Cuba, which is the biggest problem for them in bone in their throat. But it's really that chain of four countries: Cuba to the west, then Haiti and Dominican Republic, sharing the island of Hispaniola, and then Puerto Rico. And really, Dominican Republic, from which I just returned yesterday, and Puerto Rico are, you know, extremely wobbly right now. Puerto Ricans, of course, chafing under the junta, as they call it, of the banks gutting their economy. And the Dominicans are not doing much better. They, of course, having the Haitians as a scapegoat for everything has blunted some of the revolutionary consciousness of the people. But, you know, increasingly it's growing. And to me, the other element that they're really trying to stop is the march of China across Latin America, because the Belt and Road Initiative that China offers is, being taken up not only in Africa and Asia, but also across Latin America, the U.S., front yard, according to Biden, as we know famously.
Yes.
And Haiti remains one of only 12 countries left in the world that recognize Taiwan as China. So if they're trying to keep Haiti from falling under the sway of People's Republic of China, not only for that geopolitical reason, but also economic, because when the war with China finally does arrive in full force, all those factories in China that make all our electronics and most of our clothing and most of our toys, etc., are all going to go offline, and they need a place where they can get really cheap labor to do it, and that's Haiti. You know, $5 a day. You can't beat that anywhere in the hemisphere, and so they're trying to hang on they're trying to hang on to Haiti for those reasons.
Mm-hmm. By the way, I did, again, that article pointed out that Aristide was advised by Ben Dupuy to recognize China, as the world has, by the way. I mean, as clearly, it was not a new idea, but was afraid that it would anger Washington, so he didn't do it.
Right.
It's so sobering to read that. And you wrote it. It was a two-part article, HaitiLiberté.com, and it's very, very revealing. Apropos of Dominican Republic, from which you, as you mentioned, they're building a wall, a 54-kilometer wall. What's that all about? And it sounds like just more trouble.
Yeah, well, it's mostly show business, as the Haitians call that kind of policy, to appease certain ultra-nationalist and racist forces in the Dominican Republic.
Are these people inspired by Trump or something? Everybody seems to be wall-happy.
Yes, people say that, but it's a grandstanding by Abinader, president, who is now running for re-election, to show that he's tough on the Haitians coming in. Of course, the Dominican Republic could not function without Haitian labor. Everybody digging a ditch or polishing a banister or, you know, waiting a table in a restaurant tends to be Haitian. And so you really would be removing a tremendous part of the Dominican workforce that allows its not only farming, but tourism industries to continue. And as well as what remains of the sugarcane industry there. Haitians have for many years been the chief cane cutters on the bate, as they are called in Dominican Republic. So it's just like here in the U.S. and I imagine in Canada too, where immigrants are essential to the workforce. And,
absolutely.
But you have to keep them on their back foot, that you have to make them basically oppressed and illegal and so on and so forth to keep them from organizing and rising up and pushing for more. So this wall is part of that offensive, and, you know, it's not going to stop anything. Anybody who's been along the Dominican border, and I went basically the entire distance of it from Dajabón down to Pedernales back in 1991, shortly after the coup, under the aegis of Ramsey Clark, in fact. And, you know, what I really saw was not only that it would be very difficult to keep people from getting around whatever you put up there, no matter what the technology and no matter how many troops you put along there, but the fact that, you know, the populations really blend together. There's not a hard and fast line. Everybody on the Haitian side has Dominican relatives. Everybody on the Dominican side has Haitian relatives. There's a lot of solidarity there. There's a lot of good feeling there. And I think it's going to be very hard for him to do anything more than do this kind of show business wall to appease, you know, people who are mostly in other parts of the country.
Perhaps he will end up destabilizing himself, right? I mean, you point out that he's not exactly firmly in power, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, Abinader, some people like him a lot. He, I think, is doing a little better than Danilo, his predecessor, was, but he is getting a challenge from the PLD, the former party of Juan Bush, who was sort of the Aristide of Dominican Republic in the 1960s, even though he turned into almost his opposite. He did a kind of Juan Perón conversion in the course of his political life. But nonetheless, I do think that the Dominican revolutionary consciousness and progressive consciousness is growing from what I've seen. And, you know, one hopes that the emerging multipolar world will only fuel that.
Yes. We're speaking to Kim Ives. And now, the last time we spoke to you, this issue of gangs was being talked about. By the way, the media here, that's the only word they have for any public movement, any activity in the street has to be a gang.
Right.
You have, as far as I know, the leaders of the so-called leaders of Haiti today are not legally in office, which makes, if you could call them a gang if you wanted to. But you introduced us to several names and people who actually lead organizations who are fighting actually for the people's interests. Are they talking about all this stuff of intervention? And what kind of media outlet do they have? What's available to them?
Well, Haiti Liberté is, I could say, in terms of the print media, the principal, I could say, people's voice, if you will. There are quite a few radio stations in Haiti across the political spectrum, and some of them give voice to progressive analysis, but the majority of the media, as in the U.S. and Canada, is owned by the bourgeoisie and by reactionary interests, and so they put out a very reactionary line, and that includes demonizing people trying to liberate themselves, which is the case for, we spoke about Jimmy Cherizier and the G9 movement, which is emerging in Port-au-Prince out of its shantytowns. And as I told the UN, I think we discussed this on the last show we had, you know, the U.S. effort is to try to put all the people's organizations in the shanty towns in one basket called the gang. That is, anybody with a gun in the shanty towns is a gangster. And this is not the case. There are indeed criminal gangs whose sole motivation is money. And often they are working on behalf of the bourgeoisie to keep the popular movement at bay. But there is another part of the shanty towns which has organized themselves into neighborhood committees, and they are trying to stamp out kidnapping and rape and extortion of small merchants and any crime against the people. And they are trying to build a new Haiti where the poor have hospitals, schools, sanitation, electricity, internet, et cetera. And this is the sector, the latter sector, mm-hmm. the vigilance brigades, we often call them, which has been really targeted by the bourgeoisies, not only of Haiti, but of the U.S. and Canada as well. Mm-hmm. And so our role at Haiti Liberté has been to really clarify and push back against their narrative and say, no, these people are fighting for their liberation, and you are demonizing them. And unfortunately, a good portion of some progressive groups and individuals both here and in the United States and in Canada, and of course in Haiti, have been duped or taken mm-hmm. part in the U.S. State Department and Canadian narrative of demonizing the people liberating themselves.
Yeah, isn't that partly also because, you know, even despite they have the label there for humanity and they're liberals or they're progressives, is that they imbibe a lot of colonial thinking. And when they,
exactly.
if they see black people who speak another language, mm-hmm. the mm-hmm. word gang comes quickly to their mouths, right?
Right, right. Well, it's a very insidious and very deep-seated. And, you know, there's also a reflex, I could say, on the part of many, especially in the Haitian scene, to find some boogeyman, find some bad guy who we can all focus our anger at. In the first coup d'etat against Jean-Bertrand Aristide, there was a guy called Toto Constant, Emmanuel Toto Constant, who was indeed the head of a death squad, and he was trying to defend the coup against Aristide. So, yes, we all fought him, and he ended up in jail here in the United States, not for the massacres carried out in Haiti, but for mortgage fraud, because if you do take one penny
something
from the
serious.
Bank, you go into jail.
Something serious.
And then in the second coup d'etat, there was a fellow called Guy Philippe, who also was at the service of the empire and of the bourgeoisie in Haiti, and he too was the focus. So, of people's anger. But unfortunately, a number of people have mistaken Cherizier as being of their ilk, and he is not. You know, he is a very charismatic and I think very sincere in his effort to try to liberate mm-hmm. his people. He may not have all the tools yet, and that's why we at Haiti Liberté and others increasingly have said, you know, let us accompany him. Let us try to help guide him and help that movement come to good fruition in the face of this imperialist and mm-hmm. bourgeois assault on their efforts.
Mm-hmm. By the way, these individuals that they've labeled that would be the first targets of any intervention, I presume.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And that's the irony. All their focus has really been on Jimmy Cherizier and the G9. You hear very little. Yeah. But right now it's gotten extremely complex, because what's happened is there's a peace accord which is happening between the criminal gangs and the G9, because they've been fighting hard, and a lot of people have been dying in that fighting over the past two or three years at least. And now they're trying to make a truce, but this is a very treacherous ground. And we had an important article by Isabel Papillon in Haiti Liberté last week called the title of which was La Paix, Oui, Kidnapping, Non, which is saying, okay, peace, everybody wants peace. Nobody wants fighting, but we can't have peace with kidnappers. And this is what they're trying to do, is through this carrot of peace, they're trying to brand Cherizier, who wants peace, who has been proposing peace for a long time. They want to tar him by having him make a truce with the kidnappers, and hence say he is part of kidnapping, when he is not. He's been fighting kidnapping. So we've been advising him, and I think the people would, to make sure not to give any truce with kidnappers, because this is the main scourge really terrorizing Haiti today.
Yeah, that is difficult. What you describe is very difficult work. I've been using a word that probably sounds a little different. We're speaking of the man in English, they call him Jimmy Barbecue, right?
Yes, Barbecue. Yeah. That's his name from since he was a kid. You know, yes, he used to carry.
He helped his mother sell barbecue.
Yeah, his mom's barbecued meats into the market. It's in our film, Another Vision, which you can find on the Haiti Liberté YouTube channel. He explains how that's where he was nicknamed that, because there were three Jimmys in his neighborhood, and you got your last name became whatever you did, you know.
Yes.
And his was Jimmy Barbecue.
I hate to tell him, but I'm afraid for good or ill, people will know him by that name. And my impression is a lot of people have grown to like this individual, but he faces some tough choices. We're speaking to Kim Ives, and Kim, I really appreciate the time you're giving us, because this is, I think you've warned us, they're not giving up on this idea of force. And by the way, there's going to be a lot of trouble in Canada if it goes forward, because there's growing anxiety about the way the U.S. does business. And it's something that we really want to understand. And I have to ask you, the Chapter 7, how can they still have Chapter 7 now? Wouldn't the Security Council tell them you can't put that under Chapter 7?
Well, unfortunately, they kind of brought it in. They did the bum's rush on the Security Council. And so they had their puppet in Haiti, Ariel Henry, who was the de facto prime minister, make a request on October 8th. And then they rushed it in front of the Security Council and said, oh, my God, you know, Haiti's a crisis, and the fuel terminal is hostage, and it's, you know, a terrible situation. And Russia and China, who may have been able to put the kibosh on it, kind of weren't really ready yet at that point, and went along with putting sanctions on Jimmy Cherizier, who was holding the Vara fuel terminal, which is one of three fuel terminals in Port-au-Prince, hostage for Ariel Henry to resign and get out of there or roll back the fuel prices. So they agreed to putting sanctions on Jimmy Cherizier, which was the thin edge of the wedge. To do so, that means moving Haiti out of Chapter 6, which is where the UN is just advising, to Chapter 7, where the UN Security Council is seized of the matter. Mm-hmm. Now, it's a very complex game, because normally what the UN would do is, if they're going to send in peacekeepers, which they really can't legally do in Haiti, because Haiti's not at war with any. Peacekeepers are to keep peace and security between states. So if Haiti were at war with the Dominican Republic, okay, now they could send in peacekeepers, but it's not at war. However, they have the Dominican
ambassador
in there.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, they could fake one, but they probably wouldn't. The Dominican ambassador is saying, we are under assault. Our national security is being threatened by Haiti because of all these refugees coming out of Haiti. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're playing all these sort of semantic games. And now their main play, is to say, we're not going to send UN troops, because they don't want to put it under control of the Security Council. We just want the UN Security Council to anoint, to deputize, to give a group of nations or a nation the right to go into Haiti.
Paul Kagame.
Luckily, we and a number of other progressive organizations got to Russia and China before that. And as you know, and your listeners know, on December 21st, I addressed the Security Council. I explained to them what the deal is. And now they more or less get the game and are trying to keep that from happening. I mean, when I say they, I mean Russia and China.
Yeah. By the way, your presentation, that's available at HaitiLiberté.com. It was a wonderful summary of all the problems, and thank heaven you spoke there. Lastly, I want to mention that there's a very persuasive American journal that all the liberals read and think is gospel, and that's the New Yorker. And they had a wormy article by somebody who knows how to put together paragraphs. And they argued, Haiti blows this way and it's been into this problem and we're all so sympathetic and there's been. But as I read it, the only message I was getting is we have to intervene somehow.
Right, exactly, yeah. And that's John Lee Anderson's role. He's, an old hand at this. He's been, he does this kind of a sideways, insidious attack on whether it's Venezuela or Nicaragua or Cuba or now Haiti. He's basically the voice of the liberals and is very adroit at basically sticking the knife in your ribs while smiling in your face. So, he gives barbecue, Jimmy Chartier, a little more. But basically, his take from the beginning where he calls him a gangster, Chartier has spent his life fighting gangs, even though he's trying to develop a sort of a class force. So he's not, using that sort of terminology, but he is the anti-gangster, in essence.
No, I think I'm really glad you were speaking to that. But I noticed that there are sort of news services sending that article around, making sure everybody sees it. It's sort of like it's the talking points for liberals about, I agree with you that I'm sympathetic to Haiti, but we have to hit them with a hammer. By the way, if you don't mind, we spoke earlier at Ben Dupuy. We'd like to play music at the end of our shows. Is there any particular great music from the Haitian struggle that occurs to you that you could mention?
Well, Mano Charlemagne, who is, I could say, the poet laureate and the bard of the revolutionary movement of Haiti, really since the 80s until even today, even though he passed away in 2017, but he really is the voice, I don't know what, Bob Marley, Bob Dylan, something of Haiti.
He's in that category.
So any Mano Charlemagne you play is usually good. Fini les colonies is one of his best masterpieces, so you might go with something like that. He was a very great anti-imperialist singer.
We really appreciate that. We will find it and play it for our show. Kim Ives, you're a brilliant man. You did a great job at the United Nations in December. Haiti Liberté is a great publication. Thank you very, very much for talking to us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, bye-bye. Bye. This is Taylor Report, CIUT, and that's a little music underneath. Well, we're going to take a musical break. We'll be back with some more information news.